So welcome, everyone. Tonight, I'm talking about a topic that's dear to our hearts, and that's happiness, and this pursuit of happiness. The Dalai Lama likes to say that all human beings just want to be happy. And that's sort of what we spend a lot of our time, when you really look at it, doing in our lives is, in many ways, trying to set things up so that we're happy. And so I'm going to talk a bit about that term and what happiness, what we think it is, and maybe what it another way of looking at it. And I'm going to discuss it in relation to wise effort, which is one of the ennobling aspects of the Eightfold Path. So it's we talked about intention last week, and this is another one of the elements of the Eightfold Path is wise effort. One that I've struggled with, by the way, in my and I think many do, from what students tell me. So I'll talk a bit about that as well, the personal aspect of it. I'm going to begin by reading a story. Rabia. Some of you might have heard the story of Rabia. He's a famous Sufi mystic. Sufi mystic is Islamic. Rabia was searching for something on the street outside his small hut. Or her hut, sorry. The sun was setting and darkness was descending as a few people gathered around her. "What have you lost? What are you searching for? Perhaps we can help," they said to Rabia. Rabia said, "I've lost my needle." One amongst the people said, "Well, the sun is setting now and it will be very difficult to find the needle. Where has it fallen? That'll help us narrow down the area on this big road. If we know the exact place, it may be easier to find it." Rabia told them, "It's better not to ask me that question, because actually it has not fallen on the road at all. It has fallen in my house." Everyone started giggling as if she was joking. Then a skeptic said out loud, "We always knew that you were a little insane. If the needle has fallen inside the house, then why are you searching for it on the road?" "For a very simple reason. Inside the house there is no light. And on the outside, a little light is still there," Rabia replied. The people laughed and started dispersing. Rabia called them back and said, "Listen, that's exactly what you are doing. I was just following your example. You go on seeking bliss and happiness in the outside world without asking the most fundamental question. Where exactly have I lost it?" After a pause, she continues, "You have lost it inside, and yet you are looking for it on the outside for the very same reason. Your senses are outward bound. Your ears hear sounds on the outside. Your hands touch things on the outside. That's the reason why you are searching outside. For a very long time, I was also just searching on the outside. But the day I searched inwards, I was surprised. That is where I lost it, and that is the only place where it can be found." I love that story. It's a story I heard, early on, and it has many subtle messages. At an obvious level, it's talking about looking inside, the search inside yourself, which is what we know the practice is about. But do we really know it? When we sit, are we really just being with what's inside? Are we still kind of grasping, something outside? Oh, a bird, nice sound bird. Oh, does the mind incline towards it, and maybe you wonder what kind of bird, what a beautiful bird. So there's still this searching outside, a pain. Does the mind kind of go, "Oh, I hope that goes away," inclines away from it. So is there this constant kind of searching outside? But there's many There's many insights in this story. Most times I've heard it used, it's being used to point towards true happiness. So we think, so let's just unpack that a little bit, what I mean by true happiness. So kind of ordinary, everyday, ordinary happiness happens because of objects. We have a feeling, a vedna, of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral towards an object out there. So every object that comes through our six sense doors, the sixth being the mind, there's an automatic vedna automatically arises. You can't kind of stop it. You can see it. You can see it moment by moment. Even what I'm saying could be eliciting a vedna, kind of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Virtually everything that comes through our sense doors, a sound, a taste, and so on. And this is where we look for our happiness, and piling up pleasant events and avoiding unpleasant. But the objects don't last. You know, that's one of the marks of existence that the Buddha talked about, is impermanence that creates suffering. It doesn't last. A happy event is soon followed by an unhappy one. The new shoes you got wear out. Unfortunately, most of us spend our lives going through life looking for happy things that make us happy. Happy events outside. But this happy fix isn't permanent. So we keep on going. It's like almost like an addiction. We keep looking and looking for more fixes of happiness. But we continually suffer at the same time. And there can be a level of happiness attained doing that. You may find, you know, you have periods where things, you know, seem to chug along pretty good, and you can kind of say, yeah, I'm happy. So the mind kind of goes, okay, the strategy's working. This is actually working. In fact, you may even say that talk Stephen gave the other day is BS. I mean, I've got a whole week strung together now of pretty much happiness. So you can get an element of happiness from that. Of course, there will also be difficulties and pain that arise in one's life. So how one relates to that is also crucial to this conditioned happiness. So that's the kind of way we would kind of call ordinary happiness, the kind of happiness that we tend to go through life accumulating. And this is when the Dalai Lama is talking about. He's really, you know, saying people just want to be happy, and this is where they think, this is what the mind projects as the way to be happy. We don't know another way. So the other way, the Buddha talked about pitta, which is sometimes translated as bliss. It's one of the factors of enlightenment. Some people call it, true happiness. So it's not dependent on objects. It's a state of mind that is cultivated. You could say through a mental practice. And because it's not dependent on impermanent objects, it doesn't come and go. That's what, when this, you may get tastes of this, this state in your practice. You know, when we talk about, a blissful state, sometimes the mind gets very calm, particularly on retreats perhaps. And you touch into that stillness, that blissfulness, that kind of unconditioned ease and peace. That's what the Buddha would talk about in terms of happiness or pitta as a factor of enlightenment. Now, this doesn't mean a person who's cultivated pitta and has become a permanent state doesn't still feel transitory emotions. I'm amazed how widespread sort of I guess you'd call it a myth, that when somebody's enlightened, they no longer feel. Just go look at the suttas, the Buddha felt sad, felt grief, felt all those. If you look at the Bible, you'll see Jesus felt all those emotional states, throwing over the tables and the money traders' tables and the temple and so forth. So you feel those, but you appreciate that they're impermanent and essentially unreal based on perceptions. You're not grasping for wanted things while avoiding unwanted things, just allowing. I had a conversation with my teacher, Matthew Flickstein, today on the telephone. He lives in West Virginia. I'd sent him an email with a question. He's kind of come out of the sabbatical. I told some of you that he went because he's kind of come out of it already. So he said, feel free to communicate. So I emailed him a question. He emailed me right back and said, when can you talk? And I said, well, anytime. So how about in an hour and 10 minutes? I said, okay. So we talked, and what my question was, I told him I'm feeling, in my life I'm feeling, I'm feeling like life is meaningless. There's a sense of emptiness, so the empty of a self. So when identities are let go of, what's left? There's like this. I said it feels like this kind of empty nothing, and hence a sense of meaninglessness. And I didn't say what should I do, because I know that that's one of the questions he kind of goes, what should I do is there a way that wise effort could be applied here, which is pretty much a cloaked way of saying what should I do, right? So he pointed out that there's a very subtle grasping. There's a sense of self that wants to feel connected and not disconnected, rather than just being with that impermanent arising of a feeling of disconnection and emptiness. So what he instructed me to do was to stop thinking about it. Stop. Well, I'm talking about it now, so I'm not really following his advice, am I? But I'm using it as illustrative purposes. But just to stop kind of thinking about it and trying to figure it out. And I said, well, just let it be. He goes, well, just watch for that sense of self too. That's letting it be. That's in control. Notice. Just notice your moment-to-moment experience as it arises and passes away. So this notion of grasping can be at so many levels. It can be at a very obvious level that we can see where, we think that buying the best car or the nicest clothes or the material things or having the perfect relationship, that these will make us happy. We can kind of see the grasping that's going on there because it's at a very gross level, more substantive level. Some of the subtler ones, sense of grasping, becomes more subtle and more subtle the deeper this goes, but it seems to go on. So it's wanting a sense of happiness, a sense of spiritual happiness. So he said, you let go of anything spiritual. Don't even, like... And then I said, I was thinking of going on a 3-month retreat. Would that be helpful? He said, well, what are you going to do on the 3-month retreat? Like, you could just sit there and create a rut, right? You have to be very careful at this stage of what's going on, to have a teacher that can kind of guide you out of these ruts. Because I don't know if you can sit at a retreat and just kind of spin yourself into a rut. So it's very helpful to be very honest with your teacher and saying, this is what's happening while I'm sitting here. And the teacher can then sort of bump you out of that rut, perhaps, and set you on another course. So wise effort needs to be brought to this. And when I say, being with whatever arises moment to moment takes effort. Takes what's called wise effort or right effort. Padana, as it's in Pali. One of the elements of the Eightfold Path, and it's essential to the path. You see it in all the different traditions, this notion of some kind of, the word might be discipline, effort, commitment, faith, might be another way it gets worded. There has to be you really need to somehow set some kind of goal. I think that word can be slippery, but there is an element of setting some kind of goal. It's essential. Sylvia Bornstein considers wise effort the unsung hero of the Eightfold Path. In fact, it is one that people love talking about, wise view and wise understanding, the first one, and even wise intention that we spoke about last week, and mindfulness and concentration. Those are both fun to, when you hear it, nowadays you get lots of talks on mindfulness. Wise action, livelihood, and so on. You get more people speaking about it. But somehow effort, because it is a slippery kind of notion, sometimes gets left off the list or gets shortchanged in the discussion. And this work we do in our practice, and this is something that Matt said to me many years ago, is probably the hardest and most challenging thing we'll ever do. And that's why, and because of that, that's why you find people come and go from sanghas like this. And I see it. I see somebody who just seems to be getting somewhere, and you can kind of sense it. And you nudge them a little bit, and poof, they're gone. It's the challenge. It's just you're challenging this egoic self, and it's very threatening. And that's what I was pointing to with Matt. That egoic self is just going to use fear to hang on, right? Ultimately, so it's one of the most challenging things we do. So we need this continuous kind of effort. It takes effort. Now, a funny story. Well, I think it's not funny, haha, but effort's not about trying harder. That's one of the things I went through was I thought effort was about trying harder. So, type A personality, kind of a little, maybe even a little obsessive personality. A lot of meditators have that, because it takes that almost a bit of obsessiveness to like sit cross-legged or in a chair for, days at a time if you're on retreat. It takes some, it's intense. So I thought it was about trying harder. And I even had an experience where I was living with some Thich Nhat Hanh monks, and they were intense in their practice. I think I've told some of you, you've heard this story perhaps. They'd practice from, I think it was like 3:50, some weird time, 3-something, 3:50 to, bedtime basically was practice. But the whole morning was like an hour and a half sit as soon as you got up, and then an hour and a half of mindful movement, kind of a qigong movement. And then a silent breakfast, and then more practice. So very intense and very serious about their practice. And so I was practicing with them, and then the head teacher didn't really speak English well enough to give instructions in English. So I would go and ask a question, it would get translated, and then they would translate back the teacher's instructions. And what the translation was try harder, was the English translation. So I thought, well, this is just confirming what I always thought. I've got to try harder. So I actually started sitting more than the monks. So I was just like sitting and sitting, and I thought, well, if, you know, an hour and a half is good, then 2 hours must be better. You know, and then when 2 hours is good, then 2.5 hours must be even better. And so I was sitting for these ridiculously long times, but I was in absolute pain, sitting cross-legged, numbness, and then just intense pain trying to do this, just upping the practice, trying harder, sitting longer and longer. And at one point, so I said to the teacher, I'm trying harder, but I'm sitting for, I think I was up to like 3 hours. I'm sitting for 3 hours, but I'm in really, really intense pain. And what got translated back to me is, you sit too long. Okay? You don't need to sit so long. Just sit an hour and a half and then walk an hour and a half. So just do what the monks are doing. In other words, you don't have to like up it. So I thought, well, this is odd. So I said, but you said to try harder. So I thought that meant longer. And what it was actually a translation. What he was actually saying was, not try harder, but be continuous in your practice. And I'll talk a bit about what that means. It's very different than try harder. And that's what I took away is, well, this is kind of what wise effort is being continuous in our practice. So it's a gentle, this practice is a gentle, compassionate practice. So if we bring effort, striving effort, it gets in the way of openings and insights. So it's a gentle and compassionate practice. So the effort comes in being continuous, in remembering to be mindful. In fact, the translation of sati is more like remembering, remembering to be mindful, to bring awareness. So this is what I sort of, that was a kind of a turning point. Oh, okay. It's not about trying harder. Because I was impressed with these, you bunch of monks and they can just, they just sit down, stillness. So I thought, I want to, there's a bit of striving and selfing. I want to be like this, right? And so forth. So I sort of got it, being continuous. Whatever in the moment allows you to be continuous. So don't try harder. Instead, see how you can be more continuous in your practice. And watch when you get entangled in striving. When this spiritual materialism kind of comes up, and you want something to happen. You want this peacefulness and easefulness that they talk about in all the mystical spiritual traditions. So, having said that, and I went through intense periods of striving in my practice. And the other aspect of effort that occurred to me in my practice was this notion of surrender. So really balancing effort, this continuous practice with surrender. And what I mean by surrender, is surrendering what is naturally unfolding, just being with what's naturally unfolding. Not trying to, in the moment, trying to do anything with it, just allowing. It doesn't mean you're just passive all the time. You do respond to life, but you allow life to unfold in its natural It's natural unfold. It's natural unfolding. So in grasping this is this paradox. it's a paradox. One of the paradoxes in the spiritual practice is a turning point for many people. When you get that, it's just surrendering to what is. And that's what Matt said in the telephone call. Just surrender to what is. If a sense of emptiness and meaninglessness is what's arising, just surrender to it. Don't try and figure out how to fix it or what to. But because it had a deep sense of sadness that went along with it, it was something that I thought I had to work with. And the more I worked with it, the worse it got, right? Because then the striving came about. So this is the paradox, is just this surrendering, but at the same time bringing forth this kind of an effort to be mindful. You all see this. If you don't bring forth some effort to be mindful, how mindful are you really? Like really mindful, not like, yeah, I know it's kind of what's going on. I know when I'm driving my car, but the real definition of mindfulness, that awareness that arises when you pay attention on purpose to the present moment, non-judgmentally. And it's all those elements, when you really do that, how often does that happen if you don't bring forth some effort? Not a lot early on, especially early on, as your practice develops and it becomes a habit. The more you practice our habit of being on autopilot or being lost in thought, because that's what we've been used to doing, if you practice mindfulness continuously, obviously that becomes eventually your habit of mind. So I said already that surrender doesn't mean passive resignation. It means surrender to the truth of the moment. So it enables us to make effort without a sense of agitation or grasping. We have a sense of the urgency of the practice, and at the same time a softening and surrendering to what is happening. So there's an urgency. The Buddha said, practice like your hair's on fire. When your hair's on fire, that's pretty urgent. He was basically, practice mindfulness like your hair's on fire. Because that's an urgency. So bring that's effort, right? First, that image is, you're going to put that burning hair out pretty quick. So that's the urgency, but with it, the softening and surrendering around what is happening in the moment. So if you're looking at that, think, wow, that's a big, that's all contradictory, and how can those two happen? That's fine. Just let it kind of sit, and it's not a problem. Just let that be as well. That paradox. So when I have this to heighten energy. We all go through phases where our energy and our effort wanes a little. There's periods where we're all full of enthusiasm. We go on retreat and we come back and we got all these plans to meditate every morning. And, we got little notes all over the house, saying meditate and mindfulness bells on your computer and what else? All those, just all gung-ho. And then, dizziness of life begins, and then slowly it can wane. In those moments when it wanes, if this is the case for you, some people it is less so the case. There's two things you can do. You can reflect on the moment, the fleeting and momentary nature of everything that's happening. So reflecting on impermanence is very energizing, I find, for practice. A very simple thing to do is just watch everything arise and pass away, and just see the impermanence. Especially if you think, "Oh, that's permanent." Seeing the arising and passing away of everything in moment to moment experience. So that's one way. The other is We reflect on what drew you to the practice in the first place. And what happened when you began to practice in the first place? What benefits arose? Sometimes you're reflecting on that. I know for many people, I teach a lot of people where mindfulness is new to them. A lot happens in 8 weeks of practicing every day. In fact, I think more happens in 8 weeks than the next, for many people, the next year or two. It's just like, for some, it's just, wow, when it's every, you know, the practice is every day. So really look back at that first taste of mindfulness and what happened, and that can be another thing to motivate you. And effort evolves as our understanding evolves, as wise view evolves, wise effort evolves. I think at the beginning of this talk, I didn't say it, but I think I said that, Padna, effort, and sati, or mindfulness, are the most used words in the sutras. Most used words. I guess somebody counted them up, but that's a lot of counting. But so the most used. So that points to some of the, you know, the importance of wise effort, and it evolves as our as the wise view or understanding develops. So you'll notice the shift in the way that your effort is arises and is applied. I've got here. For you that like kind of lists and stuff, four phases of effort. And maybe some people find, you know, the lists and the categories helpful in sort of, I guess, sort of seeing where you're at in the way you're applying effort. So there's willful effort. That's the egoic self applying effort, self-improvement. The effort towards self, to change something about yourself. You know, I want to be a kinder person. I want to be a more compassionate person. So I'm going to change this because I'm actually really nasty deep down, and I want to fix that. Right. So there's this notion. I mean, the self-improvement field is huge. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. If you go into bookstores, it seems like it's growing every time you look at the number of books in Amazon. And this makes the contractions stronger, because the contractions are due to this sense of self, this identification with what's happening. And so we have so much of our effort with this willful effort is unwise effort. It's within an unwise view. Because it has the intentionality of gain, of self-improvement. So that's willful effort. So see if that's... Notice when that arises. And that arises, I mean, that'll arise. You know, no matter how long you've been practicing, I would, you know... Although I shouldn't say this, maybe it doesn't. But for many of us, it'll arise. You'll do something, oh, I should practice, you know, loving-kindness meditation, and I wouldn't have, you know, reacted that way. So that's a little bit of willful efforting arising. You just notice it. It's not a problem. Just notice, look at that, willful effort. It's just a little selfing around that, something to kind of watch. See, there's still some juice in this area of the self. The next is kind of a gentle effort, and this is where I find most students are practicing it. You realize kind of the limitations of willful effort. You've got, you know, five bookshelves of self-esteem and self-help books. And you're still working on the same. So you kind of go, okay, it's not working. Not to say that none of that is useful. I mean, you do have to address, and I've given talks on this in the past, how the psychological work is also important. So again, another paradox. We still do that work. I'm not dissing it, but we see that there's limitations to it, to this willful effort. And we see that efforts to change can create a backlash or an arising of the opposite of what we're actually wanting. We begin to just notice and observe what's arising with gentle curiosity. So when we're, you know, when I'm teaching people new to mindfulness, that's basically what I do. We sit and then I say, what came up for you in that meditation we just did? And then they say, well, I had this happen. And oh, can you tell me more? But it's just bringing gentle curiosity without judging it, just gentle curiosity. Oh, tell me more about that. Oh, interesting. You know? And it's just allowing people to just be curious without having to do anything about it. Exploring the nature of mind and body. So it's a comprehending rather than a surmounting of our limitations or difficulties. So we want to comprehend them, not surmount them. And the third is a wise effort, which is what the Eightfold Path speaks about it, which is based on wise view. And here we see the emptiness of self. And we begin to ask tough questions. We begin to self-inquire. We ask questions that threaten the self-identifications that are there. You know, what is this? Is this true? Who is that happening to? Ajahn Chah has a, you know, a self-inquiry process where everything that's happening, who is that happening to? Who is that happening to? And you look for the who, and you're gonna do that long, and you don't find a who. Sounds like Dr. Seuss a little bit, but you're looking for the who in Whoville. So that's wise effort, and that's what we're instructed to practice in the Eightfold Path. And effortless effort, which is what Matt was pointing to when he was asked, when he was giving me instructions. He was pointing to a shift from wise effort to effortless effort. Is abiding in a sense of being, just abiding in what is, just as it is, in the stillness, with equanimity. Being equanimous, content is another word I guess you could use, with whatever arises. So if a sense of emptiness arises, a sense of disconnection, a sense of connection, you just abide in that. You bring awareness to it. So there's no effort, it's effortless in that sense. I have a quote here with quote marks, but I don't have who said it, which is not usually a good thing. I have to take my word for it. But somebody said that. I think it's Rodney Smith, because I've got a few pieces from his work in here. So it might be Rodney Smith, the Self-Deception, a book about self-deception. Very good book, by the way. One insight, here's the quote from somebody. One insight is that effort is the basis of all suffering. The other insight is that by the complete cooling and cessation of effort, no more suffering is produced. These are two insights. Grasp them together with energy, dedication, and care. You can expect one of these two results. Every form of suffering grows out of effort. So you eradicate effort and no suffering is produced. By effort, he's talking here about willful effort. So the grasping and the aversion. Consider the harmful consequences of that effort that is the basis of suffering. But when all effort has been abandoned, there is the freedom of the effortless. So that's basically he's pointing out the first three ennobling truths, that there is suffering in life, that there's a path to the cessation of, there's a cause to suffering, and then there's a path to the cessation of suffering. So can't emphasize this enough. You our relationship to effort can really shorten the journey if we're aware of how effort is arising in our practice and in our life, for that matter. That's what that last quote was talking more about, you know, effort in our life. So bring some awareness to that. That's, I guess, what the talk is inviting you to do, is bring awareness to how effort is arising in your practice, and particularly how effort is arising in relation to this pursuit of happiness. Because that's where, you know, that's where the Dalai Lama is, when he said we all just want to be happy. I mean, would anybody disagree with that? And that's basically what we go through life doing, is wanting to be happy, make other people happy as well, perhaps, which also brings us fulfillment and happiness. So it's just, you know, how do we approach that? That's the tricky part. That's where we have to kind of turn things around. The way that we think happiness arises is more illusionary than real. And you'll see this in all the... What's interesting is this is in all the spiritual traditions, not just Buddhism. It's in every one of them, where true happiness comes from. Some people talk more about service to others as being the path to true happiness. Mahayana Buddhism talks, you know, the Bodhisattva vows is much more about the service to others, and Christianity is very much more about service to others as the path to the spiritual path. Theravadan Buddhism is perhaps, because we call it insight meditation, is perhaps more focused on the inner, looking inward at our inner landscape and how we react, what kind of habit patterns we have, and how if we break out of those, we can break out of habits that cause suffering. So, I mean, you can kind of take it all in. I mean, it all works. It's all appropriate, and it's all breaking down the identification with the self. Like when you help others, there's a breaking down of selfishness and an arising of selflessness. And just applying gentle and wise effort in that regard, and noticing when it's a willful effort. So thank you for being so attentive. Everybody seemed very attentive tonight. Some nights people are yawning. Which is fine too. Any questions about that talk or anything else that's come up for you? And for the new folks, we have this guideline where we, before we speak, we go like this, so people know you're about to speak, and we all acknowledge. And then when you're finished, you go like this, and we all acknowledge that you're finished.
Change the activity of the mind for those that are in it. but being awake most of the night because of dreaming. So curious if you or anyone else has ever experienced the quieting of the mind and sleeping.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. the practice is about falling awake. So, when we practice, there's an alertness to the practice. So that's why we sit upright. Or even lying down. Although that's a meditation posture in the suttas, lying down is you're tempting sleep. So it's a process of falling awake. Now, what happens is, many people have reported this to me, and I've also experienced this. What happens first is that your dreams become very vivid. So if you think you're dreaming now, right? Well, on a long retreat, your dreams are like as real as what your daily. There doesn't seem to be any kind of fog, or it's very real and can be quite intense. So that's the first thing. And some people, go through all kinds of things in their lives on retreat while they're dreaming. In fact, I had one retreat where I said to Matt, I think I just did like 20 years of psychotherapy last night. He tried to bill me for $150 an hour. that kind of vividness and sort of what's the word? Clearing the decks. There's a more academic word I was looking for, but this kind of working through of stuff, incompletions. The working through of incompletions can also arise. Now, the other thing that can arise, and this often comes with longer retreats and a longer time as practicing, is you can actually be mindful in your dreams. So the awareness that you're applying in your daily life is applied in the dream, so you know that you're dreaming. It's called lucid dreaming. So you actually know that you're dreaming and that you're mindful of what's happening moment to moment. Tibetan yogis they actually practiced this. They call it dream yoga, and they got very adept at it. So that's something that even if you don't practice that, can just happen. That's about all I know from personal experience and from what people have told me with regards to dreaming. But it is it's an area that's of interest to me, because I've had both of those experiences, and they're kind of like, whoa. You've reminded me to perhaps delve into that a little more. That question points directly to the paradox that I was attempting to unravel. And that's the paradox of effort and surrendering, of setting a goal and at the same time being aimless, if that makes any sense. I mean, you can look at it two ways as a paradox that you just hold, is the way that I like to look at it. The other is you can look at it in terms of, well, when we start out in our practice, we do apply some willful effort to sort of get started. The ego thinks, oh, I mean, people come to mindfulness-based stress reduction because the ego thinks, there's a self that believes that this is going to help me deal with my anxiety or my depression or whatever it might be. So we often start out that way. We quickly guide, people to, write down your, write down the goals, what you want to get out of MBSR the first day. And I'd say, put that in an envelope. So I know they're coming with goals. Put that in an envelope, seal the envelope and bring it up to the front, and I'll put them here. So we'll just forget about those for now, and we'll just do the practice. For this 8 weeks, just do the practice, and whatever arises, just be with it. And then at the end, we can open it and you can read it and see what arises. And for many people, they kind of go, wow, that's kind of a lot more happened than that, right? This is a very small goal, really, in terms of my life. I wonder if that's helpful. We do set, and I know what you mean by aimlessness and effortlessness. These are all words that are used in the Pema Chodron. often talks about aimlessness in the practice. I don't know if that's who you're referring to, but that word I associate with her somehow. So can you be aimless in your practice, so just surrendering, but at the same time applying wise effort based on wise view? Yeah. It's perhaps, I think it would be something I would discuss with a student that's been meditating for some time, and talking about effortless effort and aimlessness in our practice, letting go of a self that wants to attain anything. Somebody that's just starting out, and you tell them, oh yeah, it's all empty and it's all unreal and it's all an illusion, it's a fabrication. They're just going, So it's sort of giving people appropriate. I mean, the Buddha always, and for that matter, all the teaching masters always spoke to the person they were speaking to. They never spoke abstractly. And that's what you'll find in all the teachings. There's contradictory messages, right? You might find that, at one point you'll find a sutra where the Buddha is saying, set a goal in your practice. It's like climbing a mountain. You got to the top of the mountain. You have to have the vision of getting to the top of the mountain. And then another person will say, there's no mountain. It's just a fabrication of the mind. So it'll really depend on who he's talking to in that instance. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is a paradox. That we're practicing surrender and effort at the same time. We have to apply some wise effort in order to have a continuous, energized, disciplined practice. Yeah. So it's just one of those paradoxes that you just hold. You can't really solve. the mind won't solve it. It'll just kind of get all twisted and tangled with it. Forgot to follow my own guideline. These are very powerful questions tonight, huh? All through the path, we enjoy enjoyable things, realizing they're impermanent, as you said, transitory, realizing that grasping will cause suffering. And that's the key, those are the key pieces, right? Like it all, so, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly are all grist for the mill. Is that the saying? Yeah. They're all, it's where the practice is. So the arising of happiness is you can really look at it. Rather, or, I mean, one thing we can do is we can get carried away by it and then we can suffer. I mean, then we notice that. So it's part of the practice, but we can still enjoy it. I often talk about sunsets. I'm like a sunset freak, so I love sunsets. And I have this odd relationship with, and it would practice for some reason to really hit the rubber hit the road on sunsets. So I can be with the joy of seeing out in the country, even anywhere, a beautiful sunset, and I'll see the joy, a sense of bliss arise, and then I'll watch the mind incline towards grasping, and you see a very subtle sense of suffering. So if I can see that, I can just allow the sunset to be sunset, not to be the mind's construction of what a sunset should be, how long it should last, how many pictures I can get on my iPhone of it, and so on and so forth, to just be with it. One thing that people report when they start practicing mindfulness is pleasant events are just more pleasant because they're aware, they're alive to what is happening moment by moment. So they're really with the pleasant. They're enhanced. So the first thing we do is eat a raisin mindfully, right, in MBSR. And people, oh, wow, I never, raisin, they're beautiful. And it's like amazing, this little wilted thing, and it's life, and it's got all these flavors that explode. I've never seen any of that before. And they've got enjoyment out of eating one raisin because they were with the experience. So it can enhance the experience in that way, when we, particularly when we're beginning to practice. But I mean, it happens continuously, but we notice it more when it's because of the novelty. Yeah, so we enjoy the joy, and we also use it as grist for the mill to see how there's still suffering. So a lot of people think, oh, it's just unpleasant stuff that we got to be aware of, because that's where we're going to learn mindfulness. the pleasant stuff too. It's both sides of the equation that cause suffering. One more because it's impermanent, and the other because we create a story around it, the story of me having the experience. Two different dynamics, but to bring awareness to the whole package. Yeah, Buddhism kind of has some people give it the nod, oh God, it's all about suffering, and you know, where's the joy in this, just being aware of suffering? No, it's about being aware of the joyful aspects of life. The 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. That's part of the human experience. And just abiding in all of it. I hope that answered your question. Yeah. These are tough questions. Wow. I like it. So a little joy arises when I get tough questions. So it's a smile. Not quite like a sunset, but okay. Well, we're I'm cognizant of the time, so thank you everyone for coming. I hope to see the new folks again, and good evening.